Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks for joining us today, Tuesday, for the show, if you are listening to us in real time. A reminder that we are on Facebook Live right now at GPB News' Facebook page. You can watch us there. You can tweet us at PoliticsGPB. Before I introduce, well, no, let me go ahead and get the panel introduced because they are the keys to this show. Joining us today, Kevin Riley, the editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. We're all kind of sitting around on our best behavior because the boss is here.
It's great to be here, and if this is your best behavior, you're in some trouble.
Across from Kevin, Patricia Murphy is with us. She is... Patricia, you've been all over. You worked on Capitol Hill for Max Cleland, for Sam Nunn. Mm-hmm. You are a columnist for the Daily Beast. You know, I really feel embarrassed. I almost always check to see your latest column at the Daily Beast or at
Roll Call.
Roll Call. Mm-hmm. And I don't know when was. Do you have something fairly new?
I had something this morning on Roll Call about John McCain and sort of how he. Rescued my faith in politics, which was waning at a time.
We're going to talk about John McCain, yep. and as I said in reaching out to all of you, I'm hopeful you'll have some stories, so I look forward to that. Cesar Mitchell, former president of the Atlanta City Council, former candidate for mayor of Atlanta, we're glad to have you back.
It's great to be here, as always.
And Eric Tannenblatt is here as well. Eric is a longtime fixture in Georgia Republican politics, but in national Republican Party politics as well. He's been associated with every major presidential candidate, starting back with George H.W. Bush, George W. Bush, Mitt Romney. Did you work on behalf of McCain when he was the nominee in 2008?
After Mitt Romney got out of the primary.
Yeah, yeah.
But I have to say, this week I've been reflecting a lot on my time working for Paul Coverdale in the U.S. Senate.
I'm sure you have, and we're going to talk. Good. Then we have some stories. Okay. So as we get started, I just want to say one thing. Patricia, Eric, and Cesar, you were all here together about 3 weeks ago, I think. And as you were leaving the studio, you all said, wow, we really enjoy talking together. Could we come back as a group? So here you are. And I'm really thrilled that you are back as a group because you work good together. So thanks for being here. Kevin, you get to join this just as I do now.
I know. It's a high standard. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to live up to it.
That's wanted you here. We requested.
A little bit of pressure. When I heard Eric was here, I felt safe. But now Cesar and Patricia walking in. Wow.
All right. So we have a lot of news to talk about. But we should start the show with this. This is an important anniversary today. It was 55 years ago today that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. gave his I Have a Dream speech at the Lincoln Memorial, looking out at the reflecting pool between the Lincoln Memorial and the Washington Monument. Thousands of people crowded around the reflecting pool. And there's a famous story about the moments of that speech. He was kind of floundering for a little while. He wasn't quite sure the direction. You know, he did a lot of improvisation, as many of the great preachers like King were able to do. And he wasn't in his rhythm. And Mahalia Jackson, who was a great friend of his and who inspired him with her music, was standing right behind him, and she realized he wasn't quite on target. And she leaned into him, and she said, "Tell him about the dream, Martin. Tell him about the dream." And that's a true story. And as a result of that, he got wound up and finished that speech like this.
Let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
What a remarkable moment. Reflections on it from any of
How
you?
How can you listen to that and not get goosebumps?
I know.
I know. Yeah, it's great. Incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. We didn't. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, one of the things, I mean, being of course, a Morehouse graduate, you know, Dr. King was required reading and learning on every level. And when you listen to his speeches, though, his speeches often start, as many Southern preachers, very slow and methodical, and they slowly, slowly incline. And I think this is a great example of that. It's one of the great speeches of all time.
Yeah. I didn't, of course, play the portion where he talks about, I have a dream. But everybody knows that. I think that ending, though, that crescendo at the end is so remarkable, Patricia.
Oh, it's incredible. And then you just have to think of the horrible despair for him only to be assassinated after that. And so, to me, it sort of makes me reflect. There's a Winston Churchill line that says, success is never final. Failure is never fatal. It's courage that counts. And I think that's a good example of that, too. Even when we've had these high highs and low lows in the country, we keep going forward. Somebody like John McCain's a good example of that as well. You keep going forward and trying.
Eric?
Yeah, I'm glad you just mentioned John McCain, because as I was listening to that, and maybe it's just because it's so topical this week, I started thinking about John McCain and his life and what he fought for.
Sorry, we have an audio issue in here. I'm sorry, I interrupted you with that.
No, that's okay. I was finished.
All right. Let's move on to other news of the day. Caesar, I wanted to start with you on this because you were president of the Atlanta City Council, and as a candidate for mayor, you really were one of the first people to speak out about some of the things that you thought were going on around you at City Hall. We mentioned on the show and talked about it on the show yesterday, the fact that the feds have now demanded an enormous volume of records from Kasim Reed, all of his travel records for 8 years, records of any kind of interaction between the Partners for Prosperity, which was this nonprofit organization that got into this complicated relationship in which a check was given to them, and they paid back the city some $40,000 for a Kasim Reed trip to South Africa, I think it was. This is getting closer and closer to home, and couldn't help but wonder, knowing you were going to be here today, how you view this, having been in City Hall and having talked about this on the campaign trail.
Well, it's really sad and unfortunate, quite frankly. I think it's having a tremendous impact on the morale of city employees. I know that firsthand, talking with some of my former colleagues on the city council and employees at City Hall. I mean, you know, last year when I brought this up as a candidate, and it cost me greatly to bring this issue up, I had an idea that, you know, we were having what you would call maybe a crisis of corruption, kind of this momentary flu. But everything that we have seen and all of what's been revealed and what we know is being investigated really just underscores what really was a culture of corruption. And you know, as council president, I often ask myself, how did we not know? Well, it turns out that many things were just concealed from us intentionally and very, very actively, from subpoenas to expenditures. And the council, as a legislative body, we set the budget, but then we have a strong mayor system that allows you to have a mayor that expends the budget. And who knew that some of these things were going on? But it's my hope that we'll get past this as a city. And that's my hope, that folks who abuse power and folks who actually were a part of this certainly have to face justice.
So, Bill, I want to ask Caesar something, but I feel compelled to point out that the federal subpoena arrived at City Hall last week. But, of course, you could have read about all of this stuff in the AJC a couple months ago. So, but one of the more alarming things that happened was the South Africa trip and how the money was filtered, routed through a nonprofit and then kind of came back. I guess, Caesar, I just want to know, what do you recall about that?
Nothing other than, when the council and or the mayor would make donations there was a process that you had in place. And by and large, there were questions that were asked about just kind of, well, where is it going? But we didn't dig in deep. It was more of this kind of, we're going to trust you to actually make a donation to a real organization that's doing real work. And typically, we knew who they were. And in this case, it appeared it was going to something associated with economic development. Who knew that this was really being done to facilitate a transaction that we're seeing now is absolutely inappropriate? I remember when the story broke, I had no idea that that had occurred, number one. And number two, I remember reflecting. I said, that's going to be a problem. And your reporting as a paper and the follow-up that's happened since then, and quite frankly, some of the things that have happened currently with this current administration in terms of handling that are quite surprising to me. And I just think that is going to be a story that will continue.
I have a comment and then a question for you, Caesar. The comment
wait
is...
Wait a minute. Wait. Yeah.
I have a question, too.
Yeah. So my comment is, having traveled around the country a lot in the last several months, this is actually giving us a black eye. I mean, I'm getting asked more and more by colleagues of mine around the country, what's going on in Atlanta, in the city of Atlanta, which cannot be helpful as we look to try and attract new industry and economic development. My question, though, is what can be done going forward to avoid issues like this from happening in the future as it relates to the role of the city council being a check on the administration?
So leadership starts at the top. You know, as many of these revelations have been made, I think back on many of the proposals and many of the things I requested to be done as council president, oftentimes finding myself being attacked personally for making just sound policy recommendations around transparency. So really leadership starts, number one, at the top. Number two, I think in this moment in time, just reflecting on a recent conversation with, again, one of my former colleagues, we really have got to see the city council step up and say, you know what, our heads are in the game. We're going to do our part. You know, we're going to assume our role in a very aggressive way to communicate with the business community, communicate with the civic community, get out into the neighborhoods and let the people know that, you know, we're going to get this issue cleaned up.
You know, Patricia, one of the things about this that I think brings us into the first of all, we have no idea what this may mean to Kasim Reed's future as an individual. But one of the things that brings us into the present is a concern about and Caesar referred to it very indirectly. The city, the mayor's office, did order an investigation of especially the transaction with Invest Atlanta, which it was part of this partnership, which for whom they had the nonprofit Partners for Prosperity, and how this weird arrangement of money going back and forth worked out. And the AJC and Channel 2 News made an open records request to see the report, which exonerated everybody, which said there was no illegality here. And Mayor Bottoms said, well, we didn't have a written report. It was an oral report. Now, in fact, subsequent to that, they are starting to document a lot of this. But that in itself is troubling if the new administration is doing less than it could to really be transparent about all this.
It's a huge problem. I think it's particularly a problem just from an optics standpoint that the current mayor was the former mayor's choice to be at City Hall. And we all, there were, at the time, we were thinking, I wonder what is behind that choice. It's not to cast any direct aspersions on that, but it casts a cloud on this administration to know that this was the way that the former mayor wanted it to go. And now we have the FBI getting into 8 years of records for the former mayor. I think also, this mayor has to make a lot of tough choices coming up that the city is going to have faith in her leadership, from schools to transportation dollars. You cannot have a mayor this early in her administration who is not projecting confidence and transparency and competence. And I think it's a significant problem that could be nipped in the bud or made worse, depending on their actions in the next couple of weeks.
Well, she has proposed this transparency post. In other words, having a city transparency officer, that would be a cabinet-level position, as I understand it. Although that's gotten a little bit lost in the discussion. I'll just tell you from where I sit, as editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, we would really like to see that, so that the you know, the concept of open records and the things that we need that are really just the things that belong to all citizens. I mean, when we make public records requests, we're not asking for anything any citizen can't ask for. And I think if we could just get that done, it would do the city and create the confidence, and it would do a lot of good.
Yeah, and I think on top of that, though, and this is something that was discussed a lot during the campaign, was having almost a quasi-independent, and what I mean by that, an independent person who is able to address and put together a very strong infrastructure for compliance, for ethics, for audit controls and things of that nature, that would be independent to the extent that the mayor and the council can't just fire them, you know, willy-nilly, and they're not subject to politics. And I think that's something that would communicate, I think, a seriousness about addressing this issue. I'll say this too, Kevin. I'm trying to figure out, you know, whose garbage did not get picked up, because you all have been on top of it and you all have been very aggressive. And I think you alluded to this earlier, but for some of you all's aggressive research and reporting, some of these issues may have never come to light.
You know what, Eric? B.J. Peck, who, of course, is the U.S. attorney who's leading this investigation, he talked about this verbal report. He took a shot, basically, at the current administration, at Mayor Bottoms. He said, and this is a direct quote, "We will be bringing you not a verbal report, but instead grand jury indictments." And he's been strong about this all along. He's said at a number of news conferences when he's announced new developments in the case, he said, "Your time to come forward is running out, because the next time you see us, it will be arresting you." He's really dogged about this.
Yeah, and he's been consistent throughout the whole process, and it doesn't surprise me. I know BJ, and this is the, you know, he's acting as, you know, I would have expected him to act in that role. And, you know, I also am aware of the fact that the current mayor's only been in office in 8 months. And, you know, having worked for officials when they transition into office, you're drinking water from her fire hose without any of these other issues. So, I mean, she not only is having to build a new administration and deal with a cybersecurity attack, but she's now having to also deal with all of these issues, yeah, too.
But, Patricia, I think you said something really important. You talked about the optics, if nothing else, of this. And here's my question. Because you've been in a position of advising elected officials on their public image, I'm a little surprised, and maybe I've missed it, that we haven't seen the mayor out there in a much more public way, you know, holding a news conference, giving a speech about how determined she is. She's answered some questions, but it doesn't feel like a very proactive effort to make us confident.
My advice to someone in this position is get out in front of this. What do you know that's not under subpoena and cannot be discussed? What do you know that everybody else needs to know? Don't let us find out after the fact. There is literally no such thing as an oral report in government, at any level of government. That is a red flag that you could see from space. Yeah. So there's no such thing. Stop saying that and tell us what's going on. It's just not that complicated.
You know, when
we wondered about that.
When you all first broke the story about just the transaction, just the question of the transaction, I thought that was bad enough. But it's really like, you know, it's gone downhill. And I think, you know, I don't know if there's a scenario in which you get out in front of anything at this point. I think the storm is brewing and it's actually full-fledged at this point. And one thing you can't do is walk a tightrope in a storm. You got to get off that tightrope, and you've got to be more declaratory about where you're going and what you're going to do. You can't try to chart a course of leadership but protect the reputation and or what you might perceive as the integrity of the past administration.
I think you're absolutely right. And to Patricia's point, I mean, I think candor with the people. The one thing, though, that I worry about is that when you first come into office, you have this honeymoon, and the public will cut you some slack. And I just wonder if we've almost gotten beyond that honeymoon period.
She's had to spend a lot of capital before she could build any up.
Right.
And I think that's going to be a problem because it's a long 4 years.
You know, what I would do if I were providing some advice to someone in a role like that is I would find my way over to Kevin Riley's office and team and have a real serious conversation with the editorial
Absolutely.
Board.
Absolutely. That's another approach.
I do that.
The invitation.
Yeah. It's 2:30 on Tuesday. Okay. Let's do a press conference on Thursday. Just to say, I don't even know what happened, but I want to tell you I'm committed to finding out.
Well,
that's true.
Just to get in the game, you should know that Political Rewind has extended an invitation to Mayor Bottoms to come in and talk about this with us and help us understand how her administration, of course, they want to get
past this. Do I get to come that day, too?
No. All right, let's do this. Let's get our first break out of the way, and we can come back. Johnny Isaacson made a remarkable speech on the floor of the United States Senate last night, and we're going to play just a little bit of it and talk about just what he had in mind when he was giving his speech.
You know, selling a car can be a hassle, but donating it is a whole different story. Let us take it off your hands or off your driveway and turn it into public radio and maybe even a tax deduction. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl, the host of Marketplace, and here is how to donate.
Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or donate securely online at gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
We're back on Political Rewind. Of course, tributes to John McCain are continuing to flow in. We're continuing to hear citizens, elected officials, express their condolences and make plain how much they think he meant to the country. Johnny Isaacson got up on the floor of the Senate as one of those paying tribute to his former colleague. And I want to play just a little bit of what he said, because many people interpreted his comments as a very direct, without mentioning the president's name, slap at President Trump, who we all know by this point was a little reluctant in the way that he wanted to deal with honoring John McCain. So let's listen and then talk about just what Johnny Isaacson meant when he said these words.
John McCain was and is a great human being. I don't know what's going to be said in the next few days about John McCain, by whomever it's going to be said. I don't know what's going to be done. But anybody who, in any way, tarnishes the reputation of John McCain deserves a whipping. Because most of the ones who would do the wrong thing about John McCain didn't have the guts to do the right thing when it was their turn. We need to remember that.
Mm. So, Johnny Isaacson, there seemed to be an indirect slap at the president there. But Isaacson in that speech goes on to say, and he may have intended that, but he also goes on to talk about the fact that during the Vietnam War, he joined the National Guard. He found a way that he would not have to be in combat, and that he feels to this day a little remorse in the fact that he didn't do more for his country. And he tells us that what he was doing in those remarks, Patricia, is also talking about people who were so who went after Vietnam veterans with such poisonous remarks. And I remember it well because I was, you know, very, very strongly anti-war. And I have to say, I remember how we felt about veterans coming home. So Isaacson may have been doing both at one time.
His speech was remarkable. And I would encourage anybody to get on C-SPAN's website and watch the whole thing. Because I would say the first 5 minutes of that speech was not about John McCain. It was about Johnny Isaacson. He got his draft notice and his college diploma on the same day. And he chose to joined the National Guard, and he said, because I wanted to take myself out of harm's way and get married to his current wife, to his, obviously, his longtime
wife.
I'm sorry, his only wife.
Be careful there.
I did not mean to say that.
I think Diane would like to
Diane,
hear his only wife.
I apologize. But he also, went into great detail. He actually apologized for not doing more. And because I did work for Max Cleland, this is a wound that has never healed for a lot of Vietnam veterans and even people who chose not to go to the war, or people who chose sort of an in-between path. And Isaacson said that his best friend from home had died in Vietnam, and he has struggled with this obviously since then. But then said people like John McCain, who made a specific choice to join the service, to go to Vietnam, to put themselves in harm's way. He just said this is a moment to elevate them and never to denigrate them the way that they were when they came home. And so it was an incredible, courageous speech, and really speaks to who Johnny Isaacson is as a person.
Tom Faust just told me that we're going to tweet out that video, a link to the video of the entire speech. Caesar, Eric?
Yeah, I was just going to say that I think John McCain's passing has made a number of people sort of reflect on the country, on their backgrounds, their experiences. I think that's what you saw with Johnny Isaacson. But if you just listen to people over the last 3 or 4 days in the comments, it has really shown John McCain really brought out, I think, the best in America. And I think you're hearing that from people. And I think the president's actions with lowering the flag, then raising the flag, I think that made him look small. And I think that you heard that from a lot of people. And I think when the American Legion sent that letter representing 2 million veterans, that actually resonated with the White House. And I'm glad that the president changed course on that. But I do think it's been a week of reflection, and I think we've got, you know, 4 more days of that.
Well, mm-hmm. Just to throw in, Caesar and Kevin, it was the up and down of the flag at the White House. It was also, there's a remarkable sequence of video clips of moments, gaggles, when reporters had an opportunity in the cabinet room at one point, I don't remember the other locations, to say to the president, what do you say about the death of John McCain? And he sat stony-faced. He refused to answer at all. I don't think you have to be a Democrat. I don't think you have to be anti-Trump to wish that he had behaved differently.
Well, you know, first of all, John McCain was a great American. He was a good man. He served this country, and he was loyal to the flag and to the people and to God and country. And I think just the comments that have been made in the past by the president related to him and you know, all the way through his term as president have been unfortunate. And I think, you know, this week, with John McCain passing away, probably caught the president off by surprise. He probably thought John McCain might be around a little bit longer. But I will say this, when someone like Senator Isaacson makes a statement like he made, a very eloquent statement, a very speaking truth to power statement, I think it goes a long way because, you know, Johnny Isaacson, Senator Isaacson, is someone who you can't clap back against. It's just there's no clap back against Isaacson. And so I think that was very necessary and very fortunate.
You know, what I think this thing with McCain has done for a lot of us is it lets you reflect on those times when you've had the opportunity to really talk to someone who's been in combat. I'm lucky. I have had that experience with some work I've done on stories about World War II veterans. And when you talk to people who've been in those situations, you just recognize a quality in them that you don't see in anyone else. And that's what I would, if I had a chance to say it to the president, I'd said, you really missed out. You should have sat with John McCain, because when you can see and feel and hear someone who's been through that experience, it can change you in a way that is really powerful. And I think that that's the sad thing about what happened, is that politicians try to turn each other into caricatures, you know, at times when they get into very partisan situations. But there's much more to the ones like John McCain who are very committed to something beyond the politics.
Eric and Patricia, you were both on the Hill during his tenure as a member of the Senate. This is a good time for you if you want to share a story with us.
Well, my favorite story was from when my husband was working on the Hill for Joe Lieberman, and Todd, my husband, had gotten a book of Senate procedure and said, oh, Senator, would you sign this to me? And he said, and he said, oh, thank you, and took it home and then opened it up and read it and said, Todd, you have no idea what you're doing. And he just was so much fun, but also such a huge towering presence of knowledge and service and sacrifice and devotion and anger sometimes, but just always at the core of it, a good person who never said he was anything but a flawed human being, but just a great example for the rest of us. He was the best.
Eric, you said you were thinking a lot about your
yeah,
old boss, Paul Coverdale.
I was fortunate to spend a lot of time with Senator McCain when I worked for Senator Coverdale back in 1993 when Hillary Clinton proposed Hillary Care. It was Phil Graham, John McCain, and Paul Coverdale that went around the country holding town hall meetings against Hillary Care. And then it was John McCain and Paul Coverdale that supported Phil Graham when he ran for president in 96, when Bob Dole was the other Republican running, and most of the Senate was behind their leader. But one memory that I have that stands out, which is more recent, was the 2008 presidential campaign. You had asked me about that earlier, Bill. I was supporting Mitt Romney in the primary, and after the Florida primary, when it became obvious that John McCain was going to be the nominee, John McCain called up Mitt Romney and said, "I want to come to your campaign headquarters," and he gathered the whole Romney campaign staff, and he talked to them all and said, "Look, we fought a good fight, but you know we now all need to move on together." And that was really, I think, the birth of a long relationship between Mitt Romney and John McCain. And if you remember in the 2012 presidential primary, when there were a whole number of host of people running, John McCain came out early for Mitt Romney.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, I was going to say honesty, fairness, integrity. I think those attributes are attributes that John McCain imbued. And I think it's a reminder. This time is a reminder for us that those attributes are important. And I think, you know, I think it's very important that we embrace that.
So let me go back to this notion of what it's like on Capitol Hill. I remember many years ago, someone said to me, someone who had worked the Hill for a long time, said to me that it was a conversation we were having about the growing partisanship on the Hill. And it was in the aftermath of Newt Gingrich's ascension right before he became Speaker. He came out with his contract for America. He began to talk in the harshest partisan terms about Democrats. Many people would say that he kind of was ground zero for the sort of extreme partisanship we have today. Whether that's quite true or not, the person said to me, you know, it didn't used to be like this because families lived here with the members. When you went to Congress, your family came to Washington with you. And that meant that you came home to dinner, the member, every night to your family and the concerns of the family. The wives of Democrats and Republicans got together and socialized together. And this person said, I think to some extent, this extreme partisanship, this lack of civility, this lack of respect for one another, in some ways has to do with the fact that these guys live in a total bubble up there. What do y'all make of that thought?
Oh no, you're absolutely right. It was very different when I worked up there in the late 80s, early 90s, when I was working for Senator Coverdale. When he got elected, Sam Nunn was in office, and then Max Clinton. We worked hand in glove. I mean, we were like, you know, we were Georgians first. And, you know, you used to see senators and their families or congressmen and their families out to dinner together, doing things on the weekends together. It was much different than it is today. And it has become so partisan. And, you know, even back then, I thought it was a little partisan. And now it's completely the extreme.
Yeah. How could you be on CNN at night if you have to have dinner with your family?
Yeah, well, right. That's right. Right.
Well, McCain, you know, John Kerry said something interesting this week that he and McCain, having come out of the Vietnam War so differently, did not like each other and did not trust each other.
Sure, because remember when Kerry came out, he became the head of the Vietnam Veterans Against the War.
Yes, but then ended up in the Senate together. Yeah. And McCain took John Kerry on a CODEL, on one of these trips that newspapers hound people for and say, oh, you're wasting taxpayer dollars. You shouldn't do that. Why did you go to Italy together? You know, And those trips were hugely important to McCain, and that's where he would counsel younger members of either party, invite them specifically. I want to teach you about this. I want to teach you about that. And John McCain, what I read about today actually for Roll Call, was that to his credit, I think John McCain, when Senator Cleland was in a really tough reelection fight, and I think naively we believed that the Republicans who had worked with Cleland, as you spoke, especially after September 11th, would not campaign against him. That was just not the case. Politics was happening. We're going to beat you. I'm sorry, I can't help you. I like you as a person, but I'm sure you understand. And John McCain was one of the people who never did campaign against him, spoke out on his behalf. And that was because party was always so secondary to McCain in a number of instances. He's a political animal. He ran for the nomination, of course, but there were moments where he just chucked all that to the side. And I think that's a big piece of what we're losing, is somebody who has a view over the partisanship to the future. And that was, I think, what he brought to the Senate.
I think one of those trips that Kerry and McCain made together, if I remember this correctly, was to Hanoi.
Yes.
They went together to Vietnam, which is remarkable when you think about what you said about the contrasting views they had of the war and the way they experienced the war beyond just their views of the war. All right, let's do this. Let's take another break, get our last break of the show out of the way. When we come back, we've got a lot of politics to talk about. A little history as well. We're kind of doing it. It looks like there's become a history theme on the show. Well, we've got more, because 50 years ago this week was the week in which the Democrats brought their convention to the city of Chicago, my hometown, the 1968 Democratic Convention. There's a lot to remember about what happened that week. This is Political Rewind.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember comic playwright and screenwriter Neil Simon. He died Sunday at age 91. We'll listen back to our 1996 interview. And we'll start our series of interviews with Emmy nominees. We'll hear from John Oliver, whose satirical news show, Last Week Tonight, is nominated for Outstanding Variety Talk Series. Join us.
Fresh Air is at 3 o'clock this afternoon here on GPB.
We're back. Kevin Riley, editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, is with us. Cesar Mitchell, former president of the Atlanta City Council, is here as well. So is Eric Tannenblatt. We always call you a Republican strategist, insider, money man.
Call me whatever you want.
One of the biggest fundraisers for Republican candidates at
operative.
All levels.
I prefer operative. I think he looks like an operative. I think he wants to be an operative.
And Patricia Murphy, who worked for Max Cleland, for Sam Nunn, and now writes for Roll Call and The Daily Beast. By the way, Max was on the show yesterday paying tribute.
I heard him.
John McCain, which is really a treat to have him on for a few minutes. All right, let's take a look at a couple of things that are going on in terms of the November elections. Kevin, the State Democratic Party had a convention on Saturday. Your employee, Jim Galloway, reported to us yesterday that it was one of the biggest, most crowded and enthusiastic Democratic conventions he's seen in a very long time. One of the things that was interesting about it is that Stacey Abrams, who is stayed issue focused throughout this campaign, for the first time, or the first time with reporters around her at least, began without using his name to get a little tougher in terms of Brian Kemp. She said, you know, he's working with ancient voting equipment, how, you know, basically we don't know about the reliability of the equipment. She talked about the fact that she proudly believes in gun responsibility in the state of Georgia. She said, quote, we're going to be a state where those who exercise their right to bear arms will know we don't point our guns at children, and we arm our teachers with resources and not 45s. And that was significant because she's drawing a line that she thinks voters are going to take her side on, obviously alluding to the commercial in which Kemp holds that rifle, that shotgun, sort of at the supposed teenage suitor of his daughter, and the fact that he has suggested maybe arming teachers would be a good idea. She kind of Saturday, in a stronger way than ever, drew the battle lines on that issue.
Yeah, I think what she's trying to do, though, is go to a place where the average people agree with her more. I mean, we know that when legislature gets excited about guns, they kind of go off to pretty, I think you could argue, the closer to the fringes than middle ground. And polling shows pretty consistently that most Georgians, even if they're big supporters of the Second Amendment, tend to be a lot more pragmatic about it than maybe Brian Kemp was during the primary. I don't know, Eric.
Yeah, look, she was at a convention. That's her base. She's trying to energize her base. And she invoked a lot of fear, you know, talking about pointing a gun at someone or talking about, you know, your vote's going to get lost. She even brought up the religious liberty debate.
Yeah, I was going to get to that next. Yeah. So we say what she said. She said she would be the governor to, quote, put it into the grave for a final time. Go ahead.
Well, and so it should be expected at a Democratic convention. You're trying to energize the grassroots.
But you're not suggesting she's not going to take that gun argument to the general electorate in the fall, are you? That's going to be a major part of her platform, isn't it?
I think it is, but she's going to play to people's fear. And, you know, I think people want a governor who is forward-thinking, positive, looking to the future. And I think she'll get there. I think both candidates will. I mean, it was not even Labor Day yet, and that's sort of the official kickoff.
Yeah, I remember those days.
Yeah. I mean, I looked at this speech as, you know, speaking to the Democratic, you know, faithful at the party convention to just fire up the troops.
Well, no, I think it's a little dismissive to say she's trying to stoke the fear. She's just stating the facts. And I think when you state the facts, you know, people.
You think Brian Kemp wants to point a gun at
there's a commercial with a gun.
I think the argument would be that he did.
I mean, you know, there are problems with there's a problem with the electoral system. I mean, I think there are a number of issues. I know Stacey is going to continue to hammer, you know, on her statewide tour, jobs. I mean, the issue of Medicaid is going to come up. And I think, to Kevin's point, these are issues that are going to resonate with some and maybe not with others. But I think at the end of the day, it's going to be about voter turnout. I think to some degree, Stacey, to probably a greater degree, Brian, they're going to be trapped in the arguments they made even during the primary. I don't think it's going to be a lot of shifting around on that. It's going to be all about who can get their base out. I mean, so to your point about fear, which I think is a little bit of an overstatement, I think it's going to be about pushing the issues that resonate with voters.
Although I will say that, you know, one of the dangers, because she is proud to run as a progressive, and she has made no excuses for that, is that while you fire up your base and maybe they're energized, you also fire up the other side too. And so, you know, we're still a right of center state here in Georgia. And so, you know, she's going to have to energize the entire Democratic electorate plus some. And, you know, just in talking to conservative Democrats around the state, they're not all enamored. Some of the Stacey Evans voters are not enamored with Stacey Abrams. And the more she becomes this progressive, I think it's going to, you know, it's going to hurt the turnout of those independent voters and conservative Democrats.
I'm sorry. Let me get Patricia in here.
So I think that the then some that you're talking about are suburban women voters. There's a ton of polling out there that shows that moderate independent women and even moderate Republican women are very open to casting their votes on the gun issue at this point. I don't know if they will. It is an incredible risk on her part. I don't think a statewide Democratic candidate has gone nearly as far as she has. But she is hoping that the muscle memory in Georgia fails. I mean, the power of the Republican Party at every level, the infrastructure they have to turn out voters is so hard to compete against. She's having to shake it up a little bit. She's counting on these suburban women voters. And she's also counting on Republicans to not behave as they have in the past. I don't know if it's going to work, but she's doing something a little different, and she's behind in the polls, so she's got to start doing something and landing some gloves.
Eric, you think the president shows up in Georgia? And if so, I want you to predict a date.
Valdosta in October.
That counts.
Okay. All right. Why don't we have a pool? All right. We all pick a place.
My prediction is he'll go down to South Georgia, and we'll see Michelle Obama in somewhere in the Atlanta area.
I'm putting her in the 6th district.
Yeah, I would think that's probably. All right, but you know, Kevin, Eric said something pretty interesting. He said that you know, Stacey Abrams, there are Stacey Evans voters. out there who are not particularly enchanted with the more progressive policies of a Stacey Abrams. Well, this cuts both ways. Brian Kemp has not exactly endeared himself to the business community, long a base for the Republican Party in this state, and he's got to shore that up. And we see that he's trying to do that. We suddenly see, and we've played it on the air, we go from the shotgun on the teenager and the pickup truck for undocumented immigrants to Brian Kemp in what I think is a very effective positive spot, smiling into the camera and basically talking about it's a new day in Georgia. and so they're both, you know, he's trying to make that pivot a little to the center.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, you can say what you want, but we've talked about Brian Kemp's TV ads more than anyone else's this whole season. So, I mean, he's figured out something there, and he seems to know what he needs to do in those ads and figure out how to do it.
He won the nomination.
Yeah, he sure did.
And I mean, that the ad that he's got out now is very effective. And I think it speaks very subtly to a number of issues that Georgians are concerned about. And even some of the more recent issues that you see, even kind of the allusion to what was happening in the city, you know, around legal versus illegal. I picked up on that after the third time watching the commercial. But I'll say this. I think the playbook is being run by both candidates. I think, you know, you've got other forces that are making negative attacks, and then the candidates are speaking kind of in a very positive sort of way, particularly when they're presenting on TV. I keep going back to the fact that this is really going to be about turnout. And one thing, and maybe I'm wrong, and I'll stop on this, I know that the Abrams camp is going to continue to push this issue of energizing and getting slightly irregular voters out. The question is whether or not the Republican Party or the Republican base is going to get out in broad enough numbers, and are they going to be excited versus just saying, I'm going to default to Kemp?
All right. This is going to be a fascinating election for the reasons that all of you discussed, and it's very exciting to realize that we're in the middle of what's become a major race on the national radar. So we will obviously continue watching it on Political Rewind.
I think it's really important, Bill, for the show to do a lot on this, and I know we're a little bit cramped for time here, because there's going to be a lot of national media parachuting in,
yeah,
and they're going to kind of make their sweeping generalizations about our state.
That's exactly right.
Find out what's really going on.
Yeah, well, you know, there are some pretty smart national reporters, but you're right. It is interesting to see the difference in how people in a locality who understand things with a certain depth, how the national folks come in.
Well,
and change
and Stacey's campaign too has a strategic effort to generate national media.
Sure.
It's helping her with her fundraising.
Of course, of course.
From Hollywood and New York.
Oh my gosh. Here we go.
Don't forget San Francisco.
San Francisco, right.
He has not worked
on Nancy Pelosi. You will see the cable car in Nancy Pelosi.
You know, I was trying to get to the 1968 Democratic Convention. But before I do think we have to say that Eric Tannenblatt, not only did he just really go after Stacey with Hollywood and New York, but you will remember that just a few minutes ago, in talking about President Clinton's effort to pass a national health care plan, he's still calling it Hillary care. That was 1993, for goodness sake.
And what Eric is forgetting is that in migration in Georgia from places like the Northeast and the West and even south of here is incredible. And so it's going to be a lot of New Yorkers and Californians
and the film industry,
and Floridians and Ohioans and Chicagoans and Texans voting in this election because they live here now.
All right. In this last week of August 1968, Democrats gathered in Chicago in the middle of the Vietnam War when protests were rampant to nominate George McGovern to be their candidate for president of the United States against Richard Nixon. And we all know at this point that convention turned into one of the most tumultuous weeks in American history in the 20th century, in domestic life in the 20th century in America. We're not going to get a lot of time on this now, but I wanted to play a soundbite from the convention floor. This became kind of an iconic thing. Dan Rather for CBS is on the floor standing in the Georgia delegation, and he's there because Georgia had a split. Georgia had two delegations that wanted to be seated. Lester Maddox, the governor, brought the regular delegation. He was, of course, an arch segregationist. And so Julian Bond led an alternate delegation of a mixed, you know, an integrated group, and they fought for the right to be on the floor to represent Georgia. And here's Dan Rather trying to deal with that as Mayor Daley's security forces are bearing down on him.
We can see with our naked eye here that the Georgia delegation is walking toward the exit of the hall on the way out, somewhat happy. And it looks like a couple of the sergeants-at-arms and security people have one of the members under both armpits and forcing him out. Dan Rather?
What's your name, sir?
And what is your name, sir? Take your hands off of me.
Dan Rather.
Unless you intend to arrest me, don't push me, please.
Sir,
I know you won't, but don't push me. Take your hands off of me unless you intend to arrest me.
Wait a minute.
Walters, you can see.
I don't know what's going on, but these are security people apparently around Dan. He's obviously getting roughed up.
We tried to talk to the man, and we got bodily pushed out of the way. This is the kind of thing that's been going on outside the hall. This is the first time we've had it happen inside the hall. I'm sorry to be out of breath, but somebody belted me in his stomach doing that. What happened is a Georgia delegate, at least he had a Georgia delegate sign on, was being hauled out of the hall. We tried to talk to him to see why, who he was, and what the situation was. And at that instant, the security people... Well, as you can see, put me on the deck. I didn't do very well.
I think we've got a bunch of thugs here, Dan. If I may be permitted to say so.
Well, mind you, Walter, I'm all right. It's all in a day's work.
Well, I saw the performance, and it didn't look very good from here, I'll tell you that.
Walter Cronkite talking to Dan Rather. That's a perfect depiction of what chaos we saw in Chicago that week. And for those of us who were Chicagoans, it was a very sorry episode in the city's history. I wish we could talk about it a little bit, but we're completely out of time. But we wanted to share with you just a little bit of that history. By the way, the convention ruled that half of the Julian Bond delegation and half of the regular delegation would come together and be seated. And here's something that you may not remember. Who was nominated for vice president at that convention? Do you know, Caesar?
I was in my mama's belly.
Julian Bond there was an effort by a Wisconsin delegate to nominate Julian Bond, a member of the Georgia legislature at the time,
wow,
just a young political leader for vice president. He was too young to meet the age requirement, but all that happened in the last week of August back in 1968. Pretty interesting stuff.
Incredible.
Yeah, if you think today's Democratic Party is divided, hit rewind.
I know, conventions now are so boring.
Yeah, I don't know. We had a touch of that in 88 in Georgia Republicans.
We did have a touch of it. All right. We are out of time for the show. Patricia Murphy, Eric Tannenblatt, Caesar Mitchell, Kevin Riley, thanks for a terrific show today. I'm Bill Nigut. We'll see you all back here again tomorrow when Sam Olens and Michael Thurman will be here along with Dr. Andre Gillespie. So that ought to be an interesting show, too. See y'all then.